Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. On this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation I have with founder and CEO of Zoom, Eric Yuan. Now, Eric and I talk about a number of different things related to Zoom, including the 45 different product releases that Zoom just announced this week, as well as what Eric sees as the future for Zoom in the AI world that we're moving into over the course of the next few years. We also talk about the features that Eric thinks any person that uses Zoom should be using. We also talk about how Eric prioritizes launching different features. And finally, I get a question answered that I've long since wondered about the insight that Eric had in the early days of Zoom that helped lead it into the business that it is today. A really fun conversation that I've long wanted to have with Eric that you'll hear now.
Thank you, Logan.
Awesome. Thank you, Eric. Great to connect. So I guess I want to start off. I saw the keynote today for Enterprise Connect was entirely about AI. For people that maybe missed it, can you give just a brief overview of some of the stuff you announced?
Awesome. Yeah. So our chief product officer, Smita, she was at Enterprise Connect. We announced a bunch of new innovations, including around 45 features, primarily around AI company. You know, a year ago, we launched the AI Companion 1.0, which is more like, based on the Gen AI capabilities. You know, we just announced the Zoom, AI Companion 2.0 with agentic skills, with agentic framework and functionalities. You know, a lot of innovations around a Zoom AI Companion 2.0.
And what is, I guess, the shift, the AI companion shifting from or evolving from a personal assistant to being truly agentic? Can you give an example of like what that means?
Yeah, so a good example, take a meeting for this meeting, for example, right? So normally, after the prior to meeting, I need to prepare for agenda, right? You know, write down a notes after the meeting, I look at a summary, manually create a task. That's the way it worked before. You know, with the Zoom AI Companion agentic capabilities, essentially take this meeting, for example, after this meeting is over, AI Companion will automatically create some tasks, assigned to you, assigned to me, and we'll check, even after the meeting is over, right? That's a, an agent is doing something, on behalf of us. Otherwise, we need to manually to create the tasks based on the summary, based on the discussions.
I guess there's been a host of different AI tools that have popped up around meeting transcription and meeting summarization. And how do you think about the role that you play as an ecosystem hub for players like that versus building your own solutions in different areas that maybe relate to Zoom?
Yeah, great question. First of all, we are offering an open platform. Third-party vendors, they can build transcription tools by themselves, right? Given we have an API. At the same time, some of our customers, they would like Zoom to offer a seamless experience, everything from Zoom. That's the reason why we also offer the similar capabilities. Again, this is an open platform, up to customers to make a decision. If they want to use a Zoom built-in, all those, AI capabilities, like a real-time summary or meeting summary, creating the tasks after the meeting's over, we offer those, the features. All customers, they can go to any third party. That's okay too. Yeah.
My understanding is you all have been pretty purposeful about not charging for a number of the AI features that you guys have rolled out, which I think stands in contrast to a competitor of yours, Microsoft, who I think does charge for a lot of different stuff. How do you balance the democratization of AI and the thought process around embedding some of this stuff into your core platform with maybe the potential to charge for these things because they are so valuable?
Yeah, great question. So before we launched AI Companion, we already spent a lot of time on talking with the customers how to leverage AI to add more value for the customers. And, AI Companion offers, a lot of AI capabilities. Those features or capabilities are core, to our meeting business, and we look at everything from a customer perspective. What's the total cost of ownership, right? So that's the reason why we truly optimize our backend, you know, AI infrastructure, and try to do all we can to make sure, right, that cost wise very manageable. With that, we can offer a greater service at no additional cost to our customers. That's the reason why AI company usage, you know, is growing very well, like a quarter over quarter, 68% growth. And because of no additional cost, because of the greater functionalities. At the same time, you know, some of the enterprise customers, they would like to customize AI company, right? And to leverage our AI studio, we can monetize on that front. But the core AI company functionalities, no matter how we innovate, we still want to, you know, give customers, you know, at a new additional cost.
As you think about these AI enhancements across Zoom, launching 45 of them, were they all 45 were announced today?
Yeah. Not every 45 features are just AI companion, you know, primarily AI companion related, right? Well, for sure, we launched some other vertical services like Zoom Workplace for clinicians, for frontline workers, and so on and so forth. So.
Is there one to two things as you started exploring AI and some of the use cases that were maybe counterintuitive to you, like when you set out sort of thinking about these things and the potential for Zoom to play in the world of AI, a conclusion that you reached that was maybe not totally obvious from the onset?
Yeah, one feature, you know, we are a real-time collaboration communication company, right? Take a Zoom call, for example. You know, everything is one of real-time, you know, collaboration. And one feature like, hey, what if, let's say, logging in, we are sitting together in a local Starbucks coffee, not on the Zoom call. When we meet in person, how to leverage the AI? So we launched a feature called a voice recorder. Essentially, you know, I just put my phone on the table. And the one click along the voice recorder, right? And we automatically recorded our conversation, generate transcription, and a meeting summary, and assign a task, and so on and so forth. That's a pretty useful feature, right? And even in the beyond a Zoom call, that's one. Another one are really, you know, it's my personal favorite feature, which is calendar management. You know, like you and I want to schedule a meeting next week. You know, the way it works today, I need to call my EA, right? And talk with your assistant, right? To schedule a call. You know, a lot of steps. What if we leverage AI company? Hey, AI company, I want to schedule a meeting with Logan next week. You know, it will automatically give us some options and make a decision for us. That's a very cool feature.
I assume a lot of these things are coming from the customers in some way. But how many of them do you think that more of these ideas sort of were surfaced in a bottoms up manner from individuals that sort of saw this in the field, and maybe they're an IC who had some observation that this is a way that it could work? Or were a lot of these like top down from you or the leadership team and sort of setting the vision about where you ultimately want to go in collaboration with some of your big customers?
So good question. You know, we are 7,500 full-time employee company. Top-down push does not work. I do not have enough bandwidth to do that. Almost all the innovations are coming from bottom-up. So meaning, you know, our innovation model at Zoom is always sit down with the customers, listen to their, you know, feedback or pain point very carefully, and come up with a solution. And then talking to the customers, does this solution work for you or not? Almost all the innovations coming from that kind of a bottom-up approach.
I know you guys are very deliberate about like listening to your customers and trying to hear what they're saying, or maybe finding novel ways of addressing the pain points that they have. Are there any lessons you've learned about conducting these customer interviews in trying to hear maybe not necessarily what the pain point it is that they have, but what the problem that you can uniquely solve for them is? Are there any techniques or styles that you've come up with in sort of conducting these case studies or these interviews?
Yeah, wonderful question. So yeah, for sure, we have a formula here. Otherwise, this is a great question. Otherwise, you know, given our customers coming from, you know, online customers, SMB customers, all the way to the Fortune 100 companies, right? So every day, we received so many feedback or feature requests, right? If you do not have formula, sometimes it's really hard, almost impossible to prioritize those features. So our formula here is more like, hey, when we talk to customers, we started from the problem statement. You know, human nature and customers would say, hey, you should do this. You should add that feature, right? You should build these functionalities. You know, more like give you a solution. But we told our engineers, product managers, solution engineers, when we talk to customers, always ask, what's the problem? And make sure we're on the same page about a problem statement, a pain point. And then we work together with customers, try to understand what had happened, what's the root cause. And then, given we understand the problem, root cause, we work together to come up with a solution. And then validate with the customers. And then we are trying to build the product. Otherwise, if you do not understand the problem and root cause, quite often customers say, you do this way. Yes, we are going to ask you this way. Another customer told us, hey, you should do that way. They're really hard to manage. That's why here we follow the problem, root cause, and the solution in a framework.
How do you think about the areas that you have a right to solve those problems versus things that maybe are outside of your adjacency? Like the calendar example you gave, it's a problem we all deal with in a meaningful way. And Zoom is the start of a lot of my, or at least one of the first things I do in the calendaring process. And so I could say it totally makes sense for you guys to go down that path. I could also say there's a lot of things that are already integrated into the calendar or the email stack or whatever it is. And maybe that's an adjacency that doesn't make as much sense for Zoom to solve. And so how do you think about like where your scope exists and what is inside the boundary versus outside the boundary when you hear pain points from customers?
Yeah, again, we take a Canada for example. We look at everything from customer perspective. Customer told us, hey, they are using Google Calendar. Yeah, we integrated Google Calendar very well, right? We built a Canada client, right? And we can talk with the Google backend. Or we built a Canada client, can talk with Outlook as well, right? And at the same time, some customers say, hey, what if you offer the calendars native service, not only client, but also server as well? We also offer the native client service. And some customers say, I want to stay with the Google Calendar or Outlook Calendar. We also have plugin and to integrate it, with other third party, systems as well. Again, we know every customer is different. We try to make sure, understand the customer pain point, and come up with a solution. If customer say, I don't want to change anything, I want to stay with the Google Calendar. It's okay. We have a plugin, with that, right? And that's the reason why our solution is very open and try to address, different customers, requirements. It's really, hard for us just to build one solution. I do this way, can satisfy every customer's requirements. That's not gonna work. That's why, quite often, sometimes we need to show, oh, this is our core. This one we can leverage a third party. Again, we want to make sure either we build up ourselves or we partner with a third party. We always try to offer a solution to our customer.
As you guys made the shift to being not just a video conferencing platform or kind of a core application of which video conferencing was one of the elements to more of a AI first business, Is there anything you did specifically in the early days of that shift that if someone else is going through something similarly or trying to think about how to internalize the opportunity of AI, is there anything that you feel like you guys did uniquely well or maybe mistakes you made that you would impart to a founder thinking about this?
We beyond a video conferencing company, right? So a few years ago, we already talk about how to transform our business from being a video conferencing app, to be a AI first, work platform. So essentially we look at the, how customers in every day they work, right? Open up the email, the calendar, send a chat message, whiteboard, make a phone call, schedule a meeting and collaborate on a document, a lot of the tools, right? And the customer needed to back and forth, go to the different tools, right, to get it work done. We think about how to leverage AI to give a customer, Zoom workplace, the entire collaboration suite. This morning, I open up Zoom workplace. I can live within a Zoom workplace, can get all of my work done. I check my email. I send you a chat message, right? I schedule the call, right? I do not leave a Zoom workplace. And also at the same time, leverage AI. You know, like used to be I need to manually create a document. Now I can tell AI company, please create a summary based on my last conversation with the partner to prepare me well for the next meeting. My AI company is more like my assistant. I will try to leverage AI to look at each service we are building, how to improve that experience. You know, essentially, you know, down the road, more like AI, you know, will proactively help me get most of work done. I just assist AI company to do that.
I know we have a lot of people that live in Zoom on a daily basis. And so I'm curious if there's something that you've been using from an internal dog fooding standpoint, maybe that was a good example, but anything that you would say, hey, if you're not using this within Zoom's platform, you're just really getting a suboptimal experience, you would encourage anyone listening to adopt this tomorrow?
I think a lot of things, right? And you take a meeting, for example, right? And you turn on AI company. Like if I'm late to the meeting, you know, I just, you know, turn on AI company, catch me up, right? It's a lot of features already available there, right? You know, like, you know, live translation as well. A lot of, you know, very cool features already built in, right? I just want a customer explore all those cool features. At the same time, a lot of new services. Again, you know, take a Zoom Docs, for example, right? I think it's very powerful tools. You know, it's not like a Google Docs, not like a, you know, the max of a word, right? I can create a knowledge-based wiki and, you know, and create a table within a Zoom Docs and track what's going on after the meeting is over. We automatically create a Zoom Doc, right? To track the like meeting summaries and also the task and so on and so forth. You know, another feature I really like, which is called Zoom Clips. And very soon we are going to have a feature that's also we announced at Enterprise Connect, where, you know, I created so many videos, right? I personally created videos. You know, it's really, you know, I would say the costly, you know, how to leverage AI. I just created my avatar and 2 minutes avatar. I give it to my our marketing team. And down the road, they just use a script automatically generate a video. For our next, you know, earning call, I'm going to do that. Right. With that, I do not need to pre-record anything. I just then the marketing team, you know, send the earning call script, you know, we automatically create a video. So a lot of feature like that is very cool. And well, we beyond, you know, video conference platform. And unfortunately, you know, take some time. Many of the customers, they did not realize. Another example, we have a built-in a chat functionality. We call it a Zoom team chat, you know, something like a Slack. Or Teams, we had that for many, many years. You know, a lot of, you know, bigger customers also deploy that. It's great built-in service. And, you know, we create a, you know, here, I live on the Zoom team chat, right? I send it all the chat message with my team, with all hands, you know, after all hands meeting. And we also have every meeting, after the meeting is over, we create a chat, a persistent chat group. I can continue, you know, engaging with our employees. There's another powerful tool in a lot of our customers. They are not aware of that.
Customer education is obviously a, as your surface area increases, it obviously becomes more and more of a challenge for the salespeople, for the product team, for product marketing, whoever it is. Have you found that doing one big release or narrowing the number of times at which you're releasing and announcing features has led to better customer education, or do you guys still ship when the product's ready and work on catching up and communicating later on to the customers as needed?
Yes, great question. So given the size of a company, given the so many customers and the speed of innovation is still extremely important, you know, which is that's the reason why every time I have so many, you know, the new features, because again, we are a workplace, you know, a platform. And also we have been in the services like a Carnegie Center, you know, a lot of new services and new features. The key is really not about those of the innovation. The key is how to, you know, easily, you know, the help a customer discover those features and make sure, you know, at the right context, right? Like take the Zoom Docs, for example. You know, customers, they are not aware of this feature. What if we think about a use case where after the meeting is over, we automatically created a Zoom doc where you have a meeting summary. With that, we can expose, you know, those new services and new features. So we got to think about it from a customer's perspective, how to, you know, the embrace those new features rather than we leverage the marketing. You know, that may not work given the so complicated, you know, the services we build now because we have so many new things, right? So that's kind of the effort we're working on. And to, you know, take a meeting, for example, right? After the meeting is over, and we should tell you where to find, you know, those, the meeting summary template. Rather than before the meeting, we should tell you, oh, you should use a meeting summary template, how to customize, so on and so forth, right? So that's kind of, you know, our strategy.
As you zoom out and sort of look forward, what do you think the future of meetings looks like, maybe in, I don't know, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever time horizon furthest out you feel comfortable projecting? Are there any things that you've internalized that maybe wouldn't be obvious to just, you know, the average person going about their day using Zoom?
I think the future, just look at a meeting experience. I am very excited about the potential and, you know, innovations, you know, like, you know, a few years later, right? So, you know, how to make sure every meeting experience is very immersive, you know, more like you and I, you know, sitting together, right? And in a local Starbucks coffee, right? And a very immersive, 3D, you know, experience. And also, you know, and if I shake your hands, if you can feel my hand is shaking, that's even better, right? That's truly immersive. That's one thing. Another thing is given the AI evolution, right? We are building, the digital assistant. But the next generation of digital assistant will be digital twin. You know, sometimes, you know, might be a very important meeting and a joint, you know, by myself. For some other meetings, I might send my digital twin to join the meeting. My digital twin not only listening to the meeting over there, but also can help me make a decision as well, right? That's the world where we're going to live, right? You know, you have AI, you have AR, and together, we will make the meeting experience very immersive, very intelligent.
And so at a literal level, so that people understand it, I think unpacking the concept of a digital twin would be helpful. And so can you just go through at a very tactical, like what you mean by that? Is it going to be avatar-based? Is it the decisioning side? What is it trained on? Can you just give like a little bit more granular insight into it?
Sure. I think, you know, more like a two-step approach. The step one is more like a digital assistant, right? Based on my digital avatar and also the all the, you know, the information I can access, you know, my digital assistant can access as well. Essentially, I have a personalized LLM and also my email, chat message, whiteboard, meeting, you know, transcription, any information I can access. The data also will be fed into my personalized, you know, LLM. You know, it would be part of my digital assistant. That's more like step one. The step two, a lot of knowledge here. You know, how to make sure, let's say I download all my knowledge, my brain, right? Somehow to figure out a way to train my digital assistant. Then my digital assistant would be evolved into a digital twin, right? I think that step two, I do not think it's ready yet. We might need some neuroscience, you know, breakthrough. I think that's kind of two-step approach.
And how do you think about resourcing against something like that might feel far off to the average person and the digital twin? Like, how do you think about the allocation of resources or R&D development to something like that versus the standard products that you're selling today?
Again, you know, most of resources, you know, are working so hard on addressing, you know, customers, you know, today's, you know, the needs, right? And or maybe next is, you know, a few months, few quarters. For sure, we have some engineers, you know, work on the photo feature task, right? Maybe, you know, may not be, you know, ready for 1 year, 2 year. You can call that a lab, right? So, you know, more like a cutting edge technology, right? And we targeted for the future. So more like, you know, and most of our engineers for sure, and they build the foundational technology, you know, add more features, you know, AI companion, so on and so forth. We also need to think about the future as well. I think probably 90%, you know, are working on today's the features and the services, you know, 10%, reserved for the future research work.
You guys obviously have access to a bunch of sensitive information, and trust is such an important point of what it is that you guys do from a security standpoint, data, all of that. There does seem to be this this tension that exists with a lot of the AI products today of a desire for the copious amounts of data that people can access with the need to ensure user trust and confidence with either existing or potential customers. I guess, can you just speak to this and how you guys think about where the bright lines are that exist between the data that you want to train on and enable versus the data that you keep totally separate and is totally sovereign to the individual customer?
Yes, great question. First of all, Azuma is a very, very secure, you know, the platform. I take security very, very seriously. That's the reason why today look at most of the security companies worldwide, you know, they all use Zoom because it's very secure. But, you know, take AI or data privacy, for example, we are the first vendor who made the commitment. We do not want to use any of our customers' content to train our AI model. Period, right? So we made that a commitment. So, you know, we build our own large language model, but we use the public data or maybe, you know, partner with a third party. We never want to use our customer data. You know, that's kind of very, very clear. And if customers, they want to like a thing on this AI company, they want to get the meeting transcription, we also very, very, you know, flexible, you know, the policy. Like a customer saying, I do not want to have any data after the meeting is over. I just needed the meeting summary. We have a zero, you know, the data retention policy, right? Automatically, you know, deleted all the transcriptions, so on and so forth. And some customers say, I want to make sure this meeting is extremely secure. I do not have any company. It's okay. We supported the end-to-end encryption, which is the first vendor, you know, who claimed the post-quantum end-to-end encryption. We also support that as well. Again, the data privacy is extremely important. And we look at everything from customer perspective. We do not want to make a decision for customer. Like, hey, for this meeting transcription, we should keep it for 3 months, 6 months. No, we give a customer choice. Let a customer make a decision by themselves.
We touched on a little bit earlier about your obsession with the customer. I'm curious, was there an example in Zoom's history, maybe of a product that became important, where customer feedback maybe directly altered a direction that you were headed from a product roadmap standpoint in an unexpected way?
Yeah, it's happening every day. You know, I give one example, like last night at a dinner with a customer. And again, you know, our AI, you know, a company is based on a federated AI approach, meaning we have our own large language model with Llama or OpenAI and Anthropic, you know, and this is a federated AI approach. And some customer, especially for financial institutions, they say they want to just use a Zoom AI company, you know, our own model. We give them a choice. And or they can use all the model together as hybrid. Now, some customer mentioned, I just want to use Zoom AI company, maybe with Anthropic. I just need those two. Do you support that? Today, we do not support that. It's a Zoom own large language model or federated approach. When we get those feedback, customers say, you know, they want to pick up Zoom own large language model is one of the you know, cloud-based large language model. At this moment, do not support that. But based on feedback, we are going to support it very, very soon. You know, those kind of feedback we receive every day. That's the reason why, you know, our innovation speed, you know, truly help us stand out compared to any other competitors. Based on the customer feedback, we can quickly innovate. And very soon, we're going to give a customer flexibility. They can pick up whatever the large language model they want to use.
In terms of your stylistic approach to running the business, there's been this refrain around, I think founder mode was the term of Paul Graham, and I think he attributed a lot of the distillation coming from Brian Chesky. And for lack of a, or for a, be, a good synthesis of at least how I think about it, it's empowering the founders to sort of make centralized and maybe gut-based or forward-looking decisions that ripple through an organization, which I think stands in contrast to a lot of executive empowerment and probably elements of delegation as well. I'm curious, do you gravitate to being more hands-on and in the weeds of the individual functional areas, or do you tend to stylistically approach it more from a delegation standpoint?
Yeah, I like that conversation between Paul and the brand. I really, love that. I think most of founders, I think probably, in my view, is extremely hands-on. And from the day when I started, 2011 until today, still very, very hands-on, And sometimes you need to delegate. Quite often, it's hard to delegate, right? You really, as a founder, right? Let's say, when customer asked it to us a problem, I really look at it from customer perspective. I could have delegated to, my direct report and then delegated to another, manager and then talk to engineers. I cannot wait. I immediately Zoom call with one of the engineers. I say, trying to understand what's the problem. When can we come up with a solution? Can we deploy this weekend? This is happening every week. Right? Like a founder, I truly care about everything. And also the speed is very important. That's the reason why sometimes you have to be extremely hands-on to talk with the individual contributors, and get a thing done as quickly as possible. Because, every day customer might be suffering, from those issues. That's the reason why, you have to be extremely hands-on, sometimes a little bit of macro management. But again, the goal is to make sure they deliver happiness to our customers. As long as I have that goal, I really do not care about a delegation or not a delegation. I just want to get work done. That's it.
You all have gone through different journeys over the course of the last couple of years. I guess every business has, but you guys uniquely certainly had were enabling infrastructure for a lot of us just to survive with friends and family, and then also do our jobs over the course of the pandemic. I shudder to think of what the economy maybe looked like absent Zoom for all the stuff that you guys were able to enable. And then there was sort of this zero interest rate phenomenon that we all went through. And then we've sort of had the hangover of all of that stuff that's happened since then. I'm curious, as the dynamics in the market have changed, how has your culture evolved? How have you thought about shifting the internal values or whatever are the case, or maybe not? Maybe you've kept them consistent all the way through. I'm curious, in going through these different cycles, how you thought about what to iterate on versus what to keep consistent from a cultural standpoint.
Yeah, Logan, that's a wonderful question. Speak of a culture, that's one of the things that keep him up, in the night. The reason why, prior to the pandemic crisis, we were a relatively small company, 2,500 employee company. And I know almost all of them, right? So, and we had a great culture, and every day we were working hard to truly deliver happiness to our customers. Look at everything from a customer perspective. Whenever we got any escalation, everyone wants to say, hey, can we deliver today? Can we deliver this week? We have that mentality. But during COVID, crisis, right? Given the service demand, we had to recruit so many new employees. Essentially, within an 18-month window, we hired around 6,000 employees. On the one hand, we had no choice but to hire many employees. On the other hand, I made a mistake. We hired new employees too quickly. I can tell you the company, the culture was broken a few years ago. We are almost fix the company culture problem, right? The reason why is, sometimes we do not look at everything from customer perspective, always from look at it from internal perspective. Oh, we should add this process. Oh, we should do this, do that. We forgot everything we do here. We got to make sure customer feel happy. And we lost that. And now this, we are trying to fix that problem. Recently we just published our culture playbook. The goal is to make sure everyone really understand why we're working so hard here. What's the goal? you know, our company value just one word, which is care. You know, care about the community, customer, company, teammates, as well as ourselves. If we do not care about the customers, no matter what we do, we think we have innovation, customers, they do not care. What they care is what we can deliver our services and more value to our customers. When customers use our service, they feel very happy. Wow, it just works, right? That's the reason why, you know, we are working so hard. And again, you know, we are almost there, and to fix the culture, bring our, you know, previous great culture back. We are not there yet. Hopefully by the end of this year, I told our team, it might take 3 years for us to bring the greater culture back. This is the third year.
I know one of the values or things that you guys think about is the continuous improvement element. And I think that's one of the things that you try to instill into the culture. Are there ways that you actionalize that at a personal level, things that you do that you think enable you to continuously optimize and be a better CEO, leader, manager, whatever the case may be?
Yeah, yeah. So here, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, we have a culture playbook, which is the 9 principles. You know, one of them is in how to develop ourselves to become a better version of ourselves, myself included. You know, when you know, one of those, the cultural principle is a daily self-reflection. You know, I want to become a better CEO every day. I want all of my, you know, the managers, engineers, they also become better engineers, better managers as well. You know, what's the formula? Right here, no matter how busy we are, you know, and we always carve out like 15 or 20 minutes time every day. You know, very likely at the end of the day, you know, think about, hey, if I start over today, what I should do differently? Do I miss anything? You know, do I receive a escalation of a customer? You know, do I respond to this customer or not? Right. So it's more like a daily self-reflection. And this is one for our culture principles. The goal is make sure all Zoomies will become better. Mm-hmm. Then the company will become better. Right. If our employees, myself included, we do not become better in a world of ourselves, there's no way for Zoom to move to the next level.
You guys have moved back to more in person, in office, culture and day-to-day of work. I'm curious, it seems like most of our companies have landed almost back to where they started the pandemic, that if they were remote, they're still remote. If they were in person, they've kind of moved back to in person, plus or minus, I guess. One of the challenges that I see is there's still elements of this hybrid work that we haven't totally figured out, at least a lot of my companies haven't exactly figured out the best way of operating in a hybrid environment where some people are in person and other people are remote, and making everyone feel like they're on the same team, albeit maybe the meeting is a little different because there's some people in one room and some people on the Zoom screen. I'm curious, are there tactics you guys have taken or anything that you've done to enable hybrid work to work better or make everyone feel like they're on the same page in a meeting?
Yeah, yeah. So first of all, I would say every company, every business is different. And the way for them embrace hybrid work also different. It could be 5 days in office, 5 days remote, right? Either way works. You know, in the case of Zoom, and you know, we are more like twice a week, you know, in office, 3 days, remote work. The reason why we embrace hybrid, you know, like that, because a lot of our customers, they embrace hybrid work. We build features and services for the customers. If we do not eat our own dog food, how can we build a better service for our customers who leverage our service to embrace hybrid work? I give you a few examples. You know, like in the case of hybrid work, you know, quite often some customers, you know, they told us, hey, they need their employees to reserve a desk, you know, before you go to office. And that's the reason why we built a service, you know, Zoom Rooms, you know, a desk reservation feature, right, to have a customer reserve a desk, right? That's the kind of feature like that. Also, a lot of customers told us, hey, when they're back at the office, and the conference room experience is different. You know, they do not like the experience where, you know, if you're not in a common room, you're not a part of a conversation. Based on that, you know, the feedback, you know, we add a lot of features and to improve our conference room experience, you know, like intelligent director, you know, multiple camera support, and make sure every participant sitting in the conference room, you know, from a remote perspective side, they see a Zoom square, you know, more like a, you know, the when they all join a meeting remotely, right? A lot of features, you know, because, you know, the we support hybrid, because the customer support hybrid, because of listening to customers. That's the reason why we can, you know, launch a lot of innovations, you know, to support and the hybrid work.
There's a very famous story of your founding and working at Cisco and WebEx and all of that, that I think has served as something of a template or an example of founders striking out from within a bigger enterprise when they have a unique insight or opportunity. I'm curious, like, if we go all the way back and look at the product insight that you had at that time, if you were to distill down like what the one to two things that you saw that were unobvious to the rest of the market, what were those things? And I guess how blaringly obvious were they to you? Was it a thesis or were you pretty convinced that it was inevitable that we were going to move in this direction? And so you were pulling your hair out, trying to convince people that this is where we were headed.
Yes, wonderful question. So I started 2011, right? The year before I started Zoom, which was 2010. At that time, I spent a lot of time on talking with the customers, already realized the future of the conference will be the video centric. It's not the, you know, screen sharing centric. You know, that's very clear. And unfortunately, you know, the WebEx architecture is not about video, really about data collaboration. You know, I realized there's no way you have a best video conference experience unless you build it from the ground up with a new architecture. Very, very clear. That's the one thing. The second thing really about the mobile experience. And also meaning, you know, like, a, you know, let's say you and I that joined like back then, like Cisco Telepresence, you know, from the conf room. Some participants, they should join via their phone. At that time, don't know support. So meaning the second problem, meaning it's kind of more like a, no matter which device you're using, either laptop, desktop, mobile phone, the conf room, you have to have a consistent, great video experience. That's the second thing I realized. You have to build it also from the ground up. Those two things I realized, and there's no way to tweak WebEx. You know, you have to build a new solution. That's how I started Zoom, so.
Did people disagree with either of those two insights, or did they just, or I guess, was it the first insight that people disagreed with that it needed to be fundamentally re-architected, and that was sort of the resistance within the organization?
Well, I think good news, all the engineers agreed with me.
Yeah.
Everybody else, it disagreed. So.
What is the lesson? I don't want to disparage Cisco, but I'm curious, what is the lesson in that for other companies that maybe would be faced with a similar situation that maybe isn't identical, but has some rhyming elements to it? Are there things that you've internalized about that you want to make sure you don't let ever occur within Zoom because, you know, it led to this outcome for Cisco?
Again, don't get me wrong. Cisco is a great company.
No, I know. I want to use it more as an abstract example than Cisco. Yeah.
So my point of this is a lesson I learned, and it may not work for others. I would say sometimes if you really listen to a customer carefully, you do not ignore them. You are not going to miss a big opportunity. That's why. Or don't ignore the engineer's feedback. You know, meaning you also, as a special founder or senior executive, no matter how big a company is, always keep a very close relationship with those individual contributors like engineers. Also very important. Everything going on. You know, if you do not stay close, you know, so many layers may not work.
I've long attributed something to Zoom's early days, and I was at Battery Ventures, and we were investors in BlueJeans, which for people that don't know was an early competitor of yours, and actually I think initially was out in front, particularly in the enterprise market. But one of the, maybe this goes to the re-architecture point, one of the things that I always thought you guys got uniquely right, and maybe this is just me making it up in hindsight, so I'm curious your perspective on this, was that video conferencing was as much about audio, or maybe even more about audio than it actually was video in the early days, because there's an element of tolerance that people can have if your video cuts out a little bit. But if audio cuts out, it ruins the meeting altogether. I'm curious, I've long attributed that to an insight that you guys had in the early days, but I don't actually know if it's true or not. Is that actually a true observation that you guys had, or if I just reverse engineered it?
Yeah, so yeah, BlueJeans founder and CEO Chris is a great friend. I think the insight from BlueJeans right on, I completely agree. If voice does not work, nothing matters. You have to nail voice first. Again, that's very complicated. You know, voice OIP essentially, in my view, you know, it's sort of a conflict with the TCP/IP. You know, does not work. You have to, you know, and figure out a way to make a voice OIP work. And no matter what kind of boundaries, no matter very long distance, you know, there's a very, you know, unstable internet, how to make the voice OIP work. Again, that's not that straightforward. That's the reason why even today, you know, some of our competitors, you know, the voice quality is still not very good. So that's another reason why, you know, customers really like our service. It just works. So voice and video and extremely important when it comes to quality.
I feel like companies often have a window of time that they could start and have the success that they did. Do you think if Zoom were started 3 years earlier, would it have been too early to the market, or do you think it could have worked some period of time earlier?
Yeah, wonderful question. I also thought about that question as well. In my view, I think 2 or 3 years earlier, probably even better. But 5 years earlier, for sure, I'm already died, I think so.
And what was that? Just like the architecture primitives of building in the cloud, decisions you would have made around that time, had it been 5 years earlier versus 2 or 3?
Because 5 years earlier, you know, at that time, let's say 2016, right? And if it started, even have normally 2 years, you have a solution ready. Let's say 2017 or 18, you have a solution ready. At that time, you know, mobile phone with a camera, not that, you know, popular, right? A lot of laptops do not have video camera yet, right? When you already have a solution, you did not see a demand. You might have to, you know, ask a question, do I build a right solution? Why did not see the demand? Actually, sometimes you're ahead of a market. It's very, very, you know, risky if you're ahead of a market. The reason why human nature, we do not have patience, right? Oh, we build a solution. If you do not see the market, the demand, we might pivot to do something else. Then you might miss the market window. That's why timing is very tricky. 2 or 3 years, I think might be okay. So,
yeah. I was, there's a Emmett Shearer, who is the CEO of Twitch, founder of Twitch, said one time to me that the job, if you start too early, your job is to survive. And if you start too late, you might not have the opportunity. And so better to be early than late. And you just need to make sure that you survive long enough to catch the wave. I've always thought that's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Yeah, right on. I totally agree. So
I'm curious, like in the early days, when you were rejected a number of times, if I have this right, from a visa in trying to come over, do I have that right? And two, if so, was there anything that you learned from that experience that you think has enabled you to be the founder that you are today? Or is that just an unfortunate circumstance that, you know, you don't want people to have to go through?
I think looking back, seriously, that's a great practice. So meaning, I think that God already arranged everything, right? When I was young, already practiced never give up. If I give up, you know, that's kind of, I never had a chance to build a company like Zoom. And I tried multiple times. At that time, I told myself, you know, I will try you know, as hard as I can, you know, maybe a few years, as long as they told me I can, I just keep trying. You know, one thing I learned, and the perseverance, extremely important when you start a business, right? You know, if you have one product that don't work, try again. If you have one business that don't work, try again. Keep trying. Someday, you know, you might achieve your, you know, what you want, right? You know, and dream might come true. Again, don't give up too early. That's what I learned.
How did you maintain that confidence to keep plowing ahead, either with Zoom or with your visa process? Because I would say there's a thin line between crazy, stubborn people who, never get to where they're going versus the people that build the iconic companies. And maybe it's just the success that's the determinant of which side you fall on that. But I'm curious, just from a psychological standpoint, the fortitude to keep going, was there anything that you feel like uniquely enabled you to do that?
That's a great question. So in my view, sometimes you are stopping on the right thing, you're lucky.
Yes.
But stopping on the wrong thing, oh my God, that's bad luck. So, but how to make sure, you know, you are working on the right things? I think, in my view, in multiple things, you know, always look at everything from a customer perspective. Mm. Put yourself into customer shoes. The second thing is you have to have, a mentor. So maybe, someone who is smarter, you can count on, always, get their insights. That's the second thing. The third thing, you also need to, talk to yourself every day, like a Zoom-wide daily self-reflection. I always ask the question, am I working on the right thing? Am I, becoming a little bit more stubborn, should I pivot or not? But it's kind of every day you got to talk with yourself, talk with the customers, talk with those people who are smarter than you. Then you try to make sure you're working on the right things. Try to make sure sometimes don't be too stubborn. Right? So it's kind of, it's a little bit tricky. So
yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious, the early days, were there things that were not scalable that you guys did in the early days that enabled the success that you ultimately had, kind of brute forcing some things initially?
Yeah, there's so many, examples. One example is early on, the type of market pressure, we built a voice OIP, and for the PhD in service, which is a phone call, right? We did not build it by ourselves. We were saying, customer might be switching to the voice OIP. They do not use a phone, right, to join a call anymore. We were wrong because we partnered with a third party and we did not build it by ourselves. And when we after the launch of the service, the quality is so bad. Customers, they complain. We realized, don't look at it from our internal perspective. Look at it from a customer perspective. I think we quickly, fix that problem, build our own service and fix that problem. The lesson learned, right? So quite often, when you think and you do not need a PhD in service, you do not look at it from a customer perspective. We did not validate it with many customers and we made a mistake.
In terms of hiring, you've built out a leadership team. I know there's been different evolutions over the years as you've grown. Are there things that you specifically look for in any person that joins the company, or specific things that you uniquely try to validate in an interview process that someone has that will allow them to succeed within Zoom's culture?
Yeah. So yeah, a little bit. We took a little bit of a different approach early on. The way for us to build each functional team, quite often you might hire a leader first. Like, let's take a marketing team, for example. You hire a CMO first and a delegate CMO build a marketing team and so on and so forth, right? We took a different approach. We more like want to build a team first with quite a few individual contributors, afterwards we hire a leader, right, to make that department more scalable. We took a bottom-up approach. The reason why is, what if you hire wrong leader, right? Wrong leader hired the wrong team. If that don't work, entire team, might be gone, right? So that's why we take a bottom-up approach. That's one thing. The second thing, when we try to hire the employees, we always look at the self-learning and the self-motivation. Because startup, tons of work. Even if you do not sleep, you still cannot get work done, right? how to make sure every employee, they motivate themselves. They can learn everything by themselves. That's extremely important. When it comes to hiring a senior leaders, we like those leaders who has a greater potential. They can grow themselves along with the company grows. That's the reason why we did not hire any like VP level leaders from any other company. So it's a medium level, you know, managers or direct level, right? They join the Zoom, you know, very energetic, right? They learn a lot of things along with the Zoom growth. That works so well. But now we have to change, you know, given the size of company, you know, those are the seasoned leaders, you know, for sure will help us more. That formula will not work anymore. So meaning the different, you know, time of the company growth, you have to look at, you know, that formula still working now, right? Mm-hmm. That's the reason why, you know, look at it. We just hired a CFO for Microsoft, you know, the CTO also for Microsoft. They're all great leaders, you know, already in the corporate VP level, you know, from other companies.
Is the insight on the VP side in those scaling days and hiring people that maybe haven't done it before, or trying to bring in people that were higher on potential than experience? What was the insight or the desire to gravitate towards that? Was it so that they weren't calcified in their ways and that they could absorb Zoom's culture without being too stuck in how they historically did, or was it something else?
The culture fit for sure always number one. Assuming that, you know, all the leaders who hired it, there's a culture fit, right? The second is really about experience. Sometimes you have great experience may not help you if you do not want to learn, because every company is different, right? They might leverage the experience they gained from working with others. They come to Zoom, you know, just tell us, I do this, we do that. Even without understanding our problem, we do not like that. We would like those leaders who come to Zoom in the very hands-on, really trying to understand the problem. And then, you know, based on their experience and come up with a solution. And that's the learning, a self-learning mentality, extremely important. I think even more important than their experience. If they learn quickly, they can gain tons of experience, right, at a startup. So that's why, you know, we prioritize, you know, self-learning and self-motivation.
I'm curious if you could go back in time and tell your 2011 self something that you now know 14 years into the journey. Is there one thing that stands out that you wish you could press that time machine and go back and impart upon yourself way back when?
Great question. That's too many things. I made tons of mistakes, and I would like to tell the younger version of myself. And yeah, it's so many things. Maybe one thing I'll tell you, actually, you know, we got a great support from VCs. We raised in total 145.5 million. And when we go public, the day we made this, we became a public company, the money we had in the bank, you know, more than what we raised from VC. You know, I think looking back, that's a huge mistake, You know, we should be more aggressive and build a lot of new services, right? The reason why you get money from VC, you have to be smart how to use that, you know, and build new services, new features, you know, and new stuff. And I was too conservative and always try to achieve, you know, cash flow positive. Looking back, that's a big mistake.
That's a great commercial for my business. I appreciate that. We need founders to continue to take our money. And some of these businesses are growing so fast these days. It's a good lesson. I guess in picking those areas, do you think that, like, in using that capital and being more aggressive in going into different areas, were there certain things that you ended up just doing later that you would have pulled forward? Or do you think it would have been a different set of problems that you would have gone after had you done it in 2015, 16, 17 versus 2020?
Yeah, because early on, I spent a lot of time talking to customers. I already know what they need. They want to have a full, you know, UC solution, right? And the meeting is the first one, and the chat, and the phone, and a lot of things. They already told us. I knew that. Mm. At that time, when I started a company already, you know, I was, you know, age 41. The age might play a role. I was too conservative. I want to build a step by step. Looking back is absolutely wrong. The reason why when customers say, I badly need a phone service, we do not have that. You know, it took us another one and almost 2 years. You know, 3 years ago, we launched the contact center. right? Should have been launched maybe 5 years ago, right? Meaning, if you understand the customers, you know the requirements, why not build it now? Why you take a step by step approach? You know, that's the reason why, you know, today we look at a lot of the new services are working so hard in the pipeline. You know, we should have started a few years ago, right? Can we have a capital, but I just made a wrong decision. So,
are there things that you spend more time on now as a founder CEO that you wished you had focused in on earlier in the journey? I often find sometimes people don't lean into enterprise sales, or they, you know, maybe delegate in some ways and end up stepping into other functional areas. Are there things in your day to day that you spend more time on now that you wish you had done a few months or years earlier?
Yeah, I think one thing is really about it used to be we only look at it like, hey, you know, we only build like a 1 year plan at the most 1.5 years. We do not think of what, you know, what's the Zoom look like in 5 years, 10 years. You know, prior to becoming a public company, if we have that more like a long-term planning or 5 years planning, today is a much better company. Mm-hmm. That's the reason why I learned hard of it, right? That's why I always think about, hey, in 3 years, 5 years, what do we want to achieve? And then, you know, based on what we have today, we got to just start working on those kind of stuff. More like a long-term planning is becoming more and more important, you know, given the size, given a public company. And we did not do well before. Right? So always, short-term focus. And that's something, you know, I think I learned.
You've been fortunate enough to pick investors in the private markets as well as the public markets. Anything that you've learned about picking who to work with that you would impart upon a CEO or someone that's thinking about how to pick who are going to be the partners on the cap table?
Yeah. So yeah, early on I had a philosophy. Today is still very, very, you know, I think about it, you know, to me is two things. First of all, I want to pick someone I can work together with some, you know, forever. More like a startup, you know, is a long journey, right? Could be 10 years or maybe 20 years. You pick up a partners, you can become your great friend. You can work together, you know, even not for a business, but something else, you know, forever, right? It's kind of a lifetime friend, right? That's really important. That's the number one thing. Number two thing I really like is in particular for investors. They not only bet on our business, they also want to bet on me, you know, trust me. Because, you know, as a founder, right, sometimes you have to pivot quickly. If they really invest in your business, what if your business does not do well? You want to pivot. They may not want to support you anymore. But this reason why, you know, I like those, you know, investors or partners who, you know, truly trust me, bet on me, you know, in addition to bet on our business. That's just, you know, second thing. You know, I think as long as I find anyone, you know, I can be a lifetime, you know, friend and also bet on me, I think, yeah, I think why not, you know, to become a partner. So
as we wrap here, are there any things that you think about in our industry that you project forward in the coming decade, or just a belief that you have in a unique way about anything in the industry that you think is going to radically change over the course of the next decade, particularly as people think about how AI is going to permeate our day-to-days?
In my view, AI is already inflecting point, as we all know, right? And nobody knows what's the future look like in 10 years. I think this is the AI. It's just this crazy innovation pace on AI front. Now, today, there's so many engineers work on the product. I guess for sure we all know that. You know, so many AI engineers, you know, we deliver much more than human engineers delivered over the past, you know, 200 years. So I do not know which industry and will be extremely different, right? And truly stand out compared to other peer industries. But I would say healthcare could be something extremely interesting, right? The new drug discovery process, the way to take care of our body, right? And the way to leverage AI to make their lives better. And I think it could be revolutionary. And that's kind of, my two cents. So,
Well, Eric, thanks for doing this. It was fun to have you on and talking through all this stuff, and look forward to hopefully doing it again at some point in the future.